modiga människor. Hello and welcome to Modiga Människor, or in English, Brave People, episode 188. And my name is Soja Zachariasdotter. With me, I have Nate Lewis, who works for OUR, Operation Underground Railroad. And they rescue children from from sex trafficking and sexual exploitation. Sex trafficking is a $99 billion industry, and it's larger than the cocaine market in the world. So that's why we so badly need to talk about this. We can't ignore that this exists, even though most people avoid the subject. And with that, I say welcome to you, Nate.
Well, thank you. Good to see you again.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, and you had a safe flight home.
Yes. It's a long flight home, but it was good.
Oh, this subject, it's not a very it's actually quite terrible to talk about this. But you work for this organization, OUR, and can you tell us about this organization?
Yeah, so it is a difficult topic, but there always seems to be light in some of the conversations, and we get to see amazing stories take place, and you know, people rescued and start a whole new life and leave their life behind them. So even though it's a difficult topic to talk about, it's an important topic to talk about, because without us talking about it and without people doing something about it, it doesn't help the fact that, like you mentioned, there's 50 million people in slavery today, more than ever in the history of our planet. So we need to talk about it, and we're here doing something about it. A little background on what we do. We have an operations department and we have an aftercare department, and we're global. We're in about 39 countries. We work in all 50 states in the United States, but we equip and train law enforcement on how to build these cases and how to fight this crime online. Outside the United States, we also are used in an undercover capacity to go in and set up operations and sting operations and arrest predators and traffickers and rescue mostly children is what we focus on, but we do rescue adults as well. And then they go right into the healing journey. We work with 150 different organizations around the world, providing that healing that they need, from medical healing, mental health, education, vocational training, and just love, honestly, just giving them a real sense of humanity and rebuilding their life. So that's really scratching the surface on what we do, but in a short little explanation, that kind of is what we do.
But and how long have you been working in the organization?
I've been with the organization over 3 years now. We've been around, this is our 10-year anniversary. We started 10 years ago and we learned a lot along the way. And things have changed in 10 years, quite a bit, actually. The Sound of Freedom, which I believe is coming to Sweden soon.
1st of November in Sweden, finally.
You got to go check out this movie. That's based off the true story of one of our first operations. And it's one part of three operations that went on simultaneously. And we do some of those big arrests and takedowns occasionally. It's not an everyday thing. We do have operations running almost every single day of the week around the world. Not always quite to that extent. That one was 120 plus rescued that day. So they're not always that big, but we do a couple. Most of what we do now is online, training law enforcement, giving them the tools and the equipment, like I said, to go do the job without us to make a real impact around the world. But the Sound of Freedom, November 1st, it's coming soon. So go see that. You'll get a little peek of what we do.
Yeah. Oh, can't there is, I know that you have a lot of stories to tell, but you have also been in Europe and rescuing children.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're in several countries in Europe, actually. I can't even name them all, but just recently, if you look on our social media, you'll be able to see, and that's OUR Rescue. You'll see some of the great work and the awards that we've been given by the National Police of Spain. We work a lot in Greece. We're starting to work in a lot of different countries. I can't talk about all of them, unfortunately, here, but I would say we're close to a dozen or more European countries that we're working in.
Yeah, I've been doing some homework before this interview, and you can really see that the statistics are different around the world, and Norway, Sweden, and some of these countries. It really sticks out that in the child sex trafficking industry, it kind of peaks with young boys in this part of the world.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
According to the statistic, it's over 41%. And that really is not how it looks in the rest of the world.
There is it's a pretty high percentage. I don't know the exact, I could guess that I would say like 26% of the cases that we see in around the world are boys. It's not always girls. That's a little bit higher than what I thought, but it's not that far off, because people think that it just happens to young girls, where it actually is not just happening to young girls. We've seen a lot of boys in different regions and different areas for different reasons too.
Yeah, in Africa, it's babies, a lot of babies. And yeah. I know it's pretty common in the rest of the world, but it really sticks out in some regions.
Yeah, we do. There's some interesting things that we found with babies, from, you know, witch doctors sacrificing children to organ harvesting. You know, there's so much. And with boys, when you talk about the number of boys, and not just specifically sex trafficking, but when you talk about slavery in general, young boys, the labor side is really where you see a lot of the boys trapped in slavery, because they're just able to work hard and long hours. So, you know, a lot of the areas of the world, they're having boys do most of the physical labor. And so we see a lot of that for sure.
Yeah. So, and the numbers are so high for this working as slaves. Really.
Yeah. There's 50 million people in slavery today, and it's 12.3 million of those are children around the world. And the statistics are 41% are trafficked by their own guardian or provider. So that's another staggering number that I don't think people understand, is, you know, the parents are in desperate situations, and they do crazy things that you would never fathom doing, whether it's forced begging or selling the virginity of their daughter. You know, it's pretty crazy what goes on out there in the world.
And the numbers also got higher during those last 3 years. The situation with COVID in the world.
You're just seeing more people online, you know. When everybody went online, you know, wherever the kids are, the predators are going to be. They're not going to be on playgrounds, because playgrounds aren't where kids hang out anymore. It seems like they're on apps, phones, internet, technology, and that's where these guys are hanging out, and these women are hanging out. You know, they're on the same apps, on the same websites, on the same gaming platforms.
And people have really a hard time to take in that it's so big, and it is at this moment as we speak. I mean, children are exploited, they're being used in this now? And people, I mean, most people seems to avoid this topic.
Yeah. Well, it's a difficult topic, you know. People would probably think we're crazy. Our mission statement has the word child and sex in it. You know, like those don't really combine. Usually those are words you use together, you know. It's understandable when you think about the risk is very low. You know, the average police department, at least in the United States, has about 5 drug task force officers to 1, you know, internet crimes against children is what we call it, officer. So the risk is pretty low. And then think about the profitability. You mentioned cocaine earlier. You know, if you're going to invest in cocaine and make a profit, you have to reinvest after that's gone. You continue to reinvest. Whereas if you're selling children, you or anyone for sex, you invest one time, then it's 100% return on profit. So it's very lucrative and it's very low risk. So it is the fastest growing criminal enterprise in the world, because criminals are seeing this and there's a demand for it, unfortunately.
I mean, it really gives me the chills to talk about this, because it's so hard to talk about this.
It is, but not talking about it doesn't help.
No, I know. And that's why we're doing this.
Yeah.
Because we can't avoid it. Yeah. It doesn't stop existing.
That's right.
But can you tell us about your first operation?
My first one, yeah, that was a life-changing moment for me. I had gone on a couple. We were in Northern Africa, actually. It was we had been visiting some survivors, some aftercare homes that we work with, and just before we had actually went overseas, we got some reports of a witch doctor, and we hunt these witch doctors. We'd been doing it for a while, but some pretty severe reports of what they had done to some siblings that did not survive. So we were going to try to hunt this guy down, and then people who are paying these witch doctors to do this stuff as well. But I remember this one Sunday. It was actually Sunday, and we went to this little church where there's this. We were meeting this little boy that we were helping. He was abducted with his brother. Were sent to the market, and when they took him, they removed his hand and his genitals, and they split him open on the back of his head and neck, and they left him for dead. And some other children found him, luckily. And so we were there to look at how we can bring in doctors to provide, a new hand, a prosthetic hand, and some other things. And I remember meeting him for the first time. He still wasn't talking, and it had been a while since this happened, but he just, you know, the trauma, he wasn't talking much. And you may have heard this story, but others haven't. But I remember we were taking these leaves, and I have a picture of these leaves, and we were tearing holes in them and using them as masks, you know, kind of like a Batman mask or something. And I was watching this little boy. He was 4 at the time I was there, and trying to just, you know, with one hand tear a hole in a leaf is nearly impossible. And I thought, wow, how difficult it is just to tear a hole in a leaf to make a mask, and how difficult this life's going to be moving forward. You know, just as a young boy, and as you grow and mature, and just the trauma that he had to go through is just hard to understand. But then when we explained to the dad, he's a young man, what we're going to do to help his son, that was the first time I saw where we actually kind of rescued the parent, where not only do you return their child, but you're going to provide their child with something that they could never provide and try to give them somewhat of a normal life. And I saw the emotion in the dad's eyes, and that was the first time I saw a different kind of level of rescue. But then we go from there, we visit some sites that I won't get into too much detail. And then we go to the home where all these children who have survived these sacrifices were living and being cared for. And without going on too long, you know, I was a little nervous going in there, but it was soon, they brought the child out inside of me. You know, they're dancing and we're giving piggyback rides and playing drums and doing all sorts of things. And then I was invited into a separate room, like, oh, there's this really amazing girl. Her name's Hope, and you got to meet her. And I went in there, and trigger warning, I'm going to get a little graphic. I'll try to keep it as clean as possible, but it is the reality of what occurred. She was kidnapped at 18 months old, She was a year and a half, and they tortured her. They mutilated her for over a year, nearly 2 years. They drained her blood for some sort of sacrifice and good luck. But the lack of oxygen to her brain caused what we call cerebral palsy. So she was mentally disabled, and now she's also physically disabled. And as she's grown, her body is not growing like a normal child. So she's not even able to sit up. So she's laying there, but her smile is just unbelievable. I mean, it's truly remarkable. Even just sitting there, if you put your hand on her face or her head, like her, you know, she can't do a whole lot, but her looking up and the smile is just so amazing. I still don't even know and how or what, but it's like her gift that she gives people is this this smile. But it really instilled in me inspiration. I was so inspired to continue to do this the rest of my life and really just fight for those children that are out there that still have innocence. They don't lose their innocence from these insane monsters and predators that are out there. And an update on Hope, where she is now, is we're fighting to raise money for her because she needs medical treatment. We're bringing her to the United States by the end of this year. And it's very costly, even with the doctors and the nurses and the post-surgery team donating most of their expertise. There's still like transport and medical costs and stuff that are going to be extremely expensive, but we're fighting for her that she pulls through and continues to provide hope and inspiration to so many people, because she really truly is such an inspiration. Just to have so much joy from all she's been through is truly, I think, a miracle, you know, and reminder for me that how, you know, I'm pretty blessed and pretty lucky to have the life that I have. And my children and many people that I know and all of us at OUR should be able to fight for these children like Hope.
Yeah, we already talked about this, but I mean, after things like this, you actually go home. You go home to your own children with all this. I mean, it's not exactly like you can just ignore the fact that you seen this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
can't what
does, no. So what does it do with you? I mean, you're coming home as a person. I mean, it must do something, even if you love coming home to your family.
Yeah, I think it was even before I came home. I remember that night being in my hotel and feeling different emotions, you know, emotions I shouldn't be feeling simultaneously, you know, at the same time, you know, sadness. I was, you know, pretty inspired and moved by these children to, like, I was fired up. I'm going to go. I'm not going to stop working, you know. And then, you know, guilt from, you know, my life and the circumstances that I have, you know, it's just, which I've worked through that. But I think the one that was the most memorable, probably not for the best memory, but I'd never experienced such anger, you know, and just this extreme desire to, you know, go after these people that could hurt humans, let alone children. And that was a scary thing for me, actually. And I remember calling my wife and texting my family and then that was probably like the spark that lit something inside of me that I didn't realize for many months how it was affecting me. You know, it was triggering, you know, I've never being bullied as a child. I hate bullies. And it was very triggering to me that these are the worst bullies on the planet. Especially the things that they're doing to children when they're cutting them up, you know, and not just that, any kind of forced trauma. You know, it made me just so mad, you know, so mad. And if you don't deal with that, that anger turns into sadness, you know, and then sadness can turn into all kinds of things. And eventually, thank goodness, my organization that I work for provides, you know, us with as much mental health and therapy that we want. So I actually started to go very regularly, and it's been very effective to give me the tools that I need, you know, when doing the work that we do, and all of our team, that are out there, you know, just having the ability to, like I said before, I was guilty for comparing my life to theirs, where one of the tools I gained was comparing their current life to their previous life. You know, I think that really helped me to see that, like we talked about, it's a dark subject, but there's a lot of light when you see where they were, where they are now, but then you also get to see where they end up and where they go. And knowing that and seeing so many success stories really helps me, because I know that that's the future for so many. It just takes time for them to get there. So, but it's definitely difficult. I also think that having your own children, you kind of put your children in that situation and think, oh my goodness, what if this was my child, which creates more drive, you know, trying to balance work and life, because this job and this work becomes a lifestyle and a passion. And so sometimes your own family can become second to strangers, you know, but working through that, you know, it's a continual battle as well, because like I said, you know that one more hour, one more day, one more thing, you know, you could, my wife, thank goodness, is such an encourager, because she believes in the mission as well. And she understands that her and my children's sacrifices is to let me go or let our teams go. And I think all the families that we work with, you know, they understand that there's a big purpose here. So, you know, we've got an amazing support team at work and at home, and that's super important.
I'm so glad you're talking about this. And also the thing that you talk about, the emotions. I mean, I haven't been in your situation, and I can feel the rage. And I feel kind of sick even talking about all this.
Well, you used the word rage, and somebody shared with me at one point, which was another very helpful tool, and actually changing the word rage and just adding a word to it, and it's sacred rage. You know, that rage is actually meaningful when you use it to do something, right?
Yeah, because I can feel it. I can. I mean, it feels like I want to take my sword and go out in the world, because it's different. Yeah. I don't feel like I don't think of myself as a person who normally want to kill people, but in this situation, I might. Would change my mind, but and it's a different kind of energy and rage.
It is. It's sacred. It's what drives everyone that I work with. You know, that's you know why we're here.
Yeah. So, tell us. I mean, you've been all over the world. Did you go? No, you didn't go to Haiti because you weren't in the organization then yet.
But no, I did not. And quite honestly, right now, I probably don't think I would go there. It's pretty severe situations currently there right now. One of the most dangerous places probably in the world right now.
So can you tell us a little about what's happening in Europe? Or
yeah, I can tell you a little bit. We're seeing a very high increased number of girls from South America who are being trafficked into Europe. But we've also had extreme success. I think, geez, just last week, I can't even remember the exact number. Dozens, and then even previously before that, I remember there being just significant, you know. Most of our, not all, we can't share everything on social media, but occasionally some of these bigger ones, if you follow us, whether it's LinkedIn or Instagram or Facebook or whatever it may be, or just get our email, sign up for our email on ourrescue.org, you can kind of get some updates and kind of see, you know, what we're up to, but just scratching the surface. It's not everything that's out there, you know. We're seeing a pretty high number of girls from South America that we're helping get back to South America. You know, a lot of this happens We've seen since COVID and the border shut down and tourism stopped at some point. It's changed now, but this hasn't changed a whole lot. But, you know, they put up these false job opportunities. You know, they might set up a legitimate, like, sourcing company that sources people for jobs, and they might set it up legally through their country, and it might look legal the whole way. I mean, these girls apply for these jobs to go work at these fancy resorts, and then they get into the country, which they don't speak the language, and their sponsor, trafficker, has all their passports and brings them through customs, and custom agents aren't even trained to identify what's going on as girls being trafficked legally into their countries. And then as soon as they get in, their passports are taken, and they don't have free range to move. They, you know, they can't leave the country. They can't travel. They can't do anything. They don't speak the language. And then they're sold to a family or to a brothel or, you know, a bar or someone. And then they're, you know, we've seen a lot of this. They're immediately put into, you know, their job as a sex slave. You know, they're forced to have sex with strangers, men, very often, every day, maybe for years. You know, so we're seeing a lot of that fake jobs that they think they're going to, and they're falling for it. They're falling for it. You know, they're desperate. There's very little opportunity in a lot of these countries, and they think this is an opportunity. They can go away and work for several months, make a lot of money for them, and they can send it home or come back. You know, we've seen girls who've left their children with their parents, and they haven't seen their children in years, you know, and just sad situations. They're taking advantage of educated girls. You know, they're taking advantage of all kinds of things just because of this current situation in the world, you know. And even when COVID, when the job markets were, you know, gone, people couldn't provide. So they were desperate to get somewhere and get a job doing anything. And in some of these poor countries where there's lack of opportunity, you know, you don't have an education, you don't have a skill set. You know, a lot of them, the only thing that they have really is this, their body to make money from, you know, and which is sad. You know, that's why it's so important in our aftercare to provide opportunity, vocational training, education, and get them on a fast track to what, if they want to be an entrepreneur or a hairdresser or whatever they want to do, how do you get them what they need to be successful? Because if they don't have that, it's most likely they're going to end up right back where they were. And you can't rescue them for a night or a weekend. It's a long term. And we're committed to life. We're a lifelong commitment to the survivors. However long they want us, they can leave and come back for their entire life. We will be there to support them.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, and I was also thinking about that. I mean, when you rescue them, I mean, they need so much support, like you say, to be able to even come back to life. So do you have like a big team who works with that?
Yeah, well, we actually work with 150 organizations around the world. We have 6 regions that we currently employ people in. So we have somebody who's over each region. And then under that person, you have country directors who are in countries in that certain region, which keeping them local, not only is it cost effective for us, but it really helps for them to understand the culture. But then we just support and vet local aftercare facilities. So it's usually we found what's different. One of the things, there's lots, but one of the things is if there's somebody locally already having a home and providing services, there's probably a reason they got connected through a personal experience, and they have their own personal heart and drive, which is something you can't teach. What they're lacking usually is resources. So we can come in and give them training, supplies, and resources that they need to just fill that gap. And then they know the culture. The system is so much better. So it's a massive team. It's a network of 150 different organizations. And who knows how many employees that is. If you took all the employees inside of each one of those organizations, thousands of people, you know, working. And those are the real heroes on the front lines every day, you know, dealing with massive trauma. You know, you're talking about a kid who's gone through some of the most severe trauma in their life that most people may never see. It's tough.
I'm just trying to see the situation where you actually, I mean, you rescue a lot of children, and it's such an absurd situation. I mean, and you can't of course say that. I mean, how are they reacting? It's different from each person, but can they feel the difference between you and the others, and can they see that they are actually being rescued?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I will say there's one really cool story. It's what I was just talking about. These girls from South America trafficked into a place of living literally behind bars. It's very similar to a cage, and let out to have sex. Some of them there for several years. Most of them had children. When the teams were in this place, and I'm not even going to share where it is, but there was these girls, and one really brave girl who felt something different from our team. And so took a piece of paper and wrote with her left hand so they couldn't recognize her handwriting. And in Spanish said, "Help us, please." And so the team member, we still have that. Actually, it's encased in a memorabilia case that we have from that operation. We have certain relics that just mean a lot, but they were literally locking these girls up with padlocks at night, you know, or morning during the day, and only letting them out. And we have the padlock too, actually. And this is all video footage of all this. It's a documentary that may come out at some point, but they sensed something different, you know, and they had been praying for somebody, because the scary part about all this and in the documentary, if we ever release it, is the cops turn on us. So the cops are part of it. They're, you know, we deal with a lot of corrupt police around the world. Mm. And so if the police are their only hope of getting out of this and they're involved with it, oh man, I mean, you're looking at very hopeless lives, you know, which is why we go into the worst, darkest corners of the world, because we're their only hope in a lot of these circumstances, because the cops sure as heck ain't helping them. They're adding to the problem, and they're actually building a distrust between law enforcement. And so a lot of the times, that's why our aftercare is there. They sign off on this on our busts, because they have to come in with the police, because the girls usually and boys usually think they're in trouble, you know, because there's cops there, but you have to explain to them very quickly they're not. And then they get interviewed. There's a whole long process. There's so much detail, you know, even the interview rooms that we're using and training police to, it's not an interrogation. You know, these girls are victims and not volunteers. And that's a huge awakening for law enforcement to be going through just in the recent years. You know, for a long period of time, you know, prostitution was looked at as they're all criminals. You know, they're volunteering to do this. Well, it's not really the case so much anymore. You're seeing a lot of these girls or victims over and over and over for years, and to treat them like a criminal does not help the situation. But treating them with respect and dignity and actually interviewing them and not interrogating them once they're rescued is helps with their healing as well, instead of re-traumatizing them. We even have rooms that are developed for these investigations where they're videoed and they're in there, and the colors and everything are significant to keeping them comfortable. And they only have to tell their story one time, and that on the other side of the wall is all the medical staff, investigators, prosecutors, detectives, everybody. And they can just ask questions once instead of the victim reliving it over and over and over and over to everyone that they have to tell the story to. Because even if your sexual experiences are great ones, it's uncomfortable to talk about them with strangers. But I can guarantee you they aren't comfortable conversations to have. And it's traumatizing. And we also have mock courtrooms that we build, because when these children have to take the stand in front of the predators during the case, they lock up and they freeze up. They see the person, and there's so much baggage and trauma from the past there that it doesn't help the case. So if they can go in and practice in a fake courtroom that we build, it really helps them get on the stand. And we're there to support them through that as well, through the courts, financially getting them through there. We got teams that are trying to help with the restitution. So if we can take, you know, traffickers' cars and homes and stuff and use that money to help these survivors and give it to them to help them start their businesses or whatever, we do that as well. We're there in every way, shape, or form that we can be.
There's so many different levels in what you take up now. And the thing with that, the cops aren't actually doing what they are paid for. It's it's not actually new for me, but it's really hard to take in anyway, because they are paid to support people and help people. And instead, some of the cops are actually involved, as you say. And in Sweden also, if you are sexually abused and goes to the cops, you have this, like you said, I mean, they interview you. And I've been reading so many of this. And most of the cops, they are not very well skilled at doing this. Mm-hmm. So it's like another trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel sick when I read this, because I can clearly see that the cops aren't doing a very good job. And then, I mean, the next thing, I mean, in Sweden at least, it's if it ever goes to court, I mean, the chance getting arrested and put in jail is like zero.
Well, that's why, one, it's so important, the work that we do to train law enforcement to build the cases that will hold up in court, and then giving them the tools to extract evidence from phones and computers and take the stand, be certified to do that work, and then use that evidence to lock them up for a long time. And the more evidence we can find on them, the longer their sentencing is. And we also get into their phones and stuff, and you find more predators, but in their network, you also find more victims. So there's a lot of leads in there as well. And one of the cool things that I haven't talked about, which is a very cool thing in the United States and actually internationally, that we're pioneering this with a guy named Todd Jordan, is our canine program. These canines will go in after the search warrant, and humans go in and search these areas. And you got to understand, a lot of these areas, they're hoarders. You know, these places are gross and full of stuff and junk and garbage, and in a trailer sometimes, and they're just stacked with stuff, you know, and it can be very difficult to find this stuff. And they hide it because they understand, you know, having a child, we don't call it pornography because it's not something that they have agreed to, these children. It's called child sexual abuse material, or what I like to call child sexual assault material, because they're assaulting a child sexually. But they video this stuff, or they use it online, or they collateral, they trade it, or they're hoarding all this stuff on these thumb drives, micro SDs, wherever it may be. And the more that we have, the more we have, we can prosecute them with. But when a team goes in and does a search, 75% of the time they miss some of the stuff. So we have canines that are trained to find it. Since 75% of the time they go in and find it when the humans missed it, which is so critically important. These canines are just so valuable. It's like a drug sniffing dog or a bomb sniffing dog, but they smell a component on all electronics have in common. And so they find this stuff everywhere, and they're amazing. These dogs and these handlers too, they're just amazing and doing some work that is super valuable to law enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, it's fantastic that they actually can do that. And I mean, the work you do, Nate, it is fantastic that you do this, and that you actually, I don't know what to say, really. I mean, the most people probably wouldn't be able to handle what you do.
Yeah, we're all called, we feel, to be here. And, you know, it takes a person who selfless, you know, want to do something to better humanity and the world and protect our children. You know, I think most people are driven because they have children, or maybe they were abused as a child or whatever it may be. And so they, you know, there's a drive, you know, I call it a fire. You know, I told you that first mission I went on was like a spark, and that lit a fire, and it just keeps growing. And the more stories I hear, the more experience I have, is like pouring gas on it. It just grows more. The more you see, the more you know. You mentioned earlier you can't ignore it. Well, that's a definite. Not only can you not ignore it, but what more can you do about it is really when the more you know is the more you want to do something about it.
I'm grateful that we did this interview, and I'm also grateful that, I mean, a lot of people in Sweden have been mailing and texting to the biograph. I don't know what is the word in English. Yeah, cinemas. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, we didn't thought Sound of Freedom would ever come to the cinemas. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but finally. Yeah, and of course they really trying to say that it's like an höger right extreme kind of movie. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting that happened here too. But the beauty is that this has nothing to do with politics. This is about children, and if you can't separate that from this, then it tells me what side you're on, then you're probably involved in it, to be honest with you. Because if you're not for protecting children, you're probably for abusing children. And quite honestly, you can say whatever you want about the movie and say whatever you want. I know the truth. And there's millions of children out there who know the truth too. And they don't care about your politics. They just want help. And if you can't look past all that and just look at the facts are out there. It's not just me sharing them. They're all over. You know, I mean, even look at the UN has a huge documentation that they publish every other year on trafficking. It's very hard to get a number, but I mean, it's happening. And people are starting to wake up. And that's the amazing thing. And this movie has woken up countries, organizations, political leaders, not only in the United States, but all over the world. Presidents are starting to change laws and how they fight and asking for help. And that's the whole point of all of this. You know, is that you have to have a group of people who get loud enough, be the voice for these kids who are voiceless, that say enough is enough. Yeah, drugs are killing people all the time. Who's out there doing anything to protect our children when we know the crime's happening? We know it. And we can prove it.
Yeah, and the statistics are I mean, it makes me speechless. Like, it's so high. It's so high. So we can't ignore it.
Yeah, and I hope, you know, not just in Sweden, but the rest of the countries that are starting to see this movie, I hope, you know, their world leaders and country leaders are seeing this and starting to ask themselves and question themselves, are they doing enough? You know, I just hope.
It's kind of easy to answer that. I mean, with the statistics, I mean, no, they are not doing enough. But I feel so grateful. I mean, for the work you do and your partners in this organization.
Mm. Well, we're honored to do it. So.
Yeah.
Look, if there's anyone listening that has any kind of relationships with any governments, anywhere, law enforcement, it's important for you to know, have a conversation. We only provide resources for free, no cost, training and equipment to fight and equip law enforcement to fight it in your communities. That's it. It's too good to be true. Yes, it's too good and it's true. So, let them know we're here to be a resource, because it's the people who want to help. It's the people who are, we're funded 100% by the people. We get no federal, state funding. And it's the people who are saying, enough, go here, take some money, go out there and equip our law enforcement with the tools and the training that they need to fight in our communities, because they're not getting the funding anywhere else. They're not, they're just not. No one's making it a priority. So that's why we have the people funding through us, not to us. I think that's what's really important for people to understand. A lot of organizations are saying, hey, give to us, give to us. We're not saying that. We're saying give through us. We have the relationships. We have the connections. We can equip and have the network set up all over the world to quickly implement all these things I mentioned. We just need to have the resources to do it. And once our, so quote unquote, gas runs out, we can't do anything. And you know who fills up our gas tank? You, all of you. You know, we literally can't do it. Everybody thanks us for everything that we do. And we say, no, thank you. Because if people stopped giving to us, we can't do anything. Like our hands are tied then at that point. So it's really up to the people. And what's really hard for people to understand is that, and you may hear this, and people think like, well, I can't really make a difference. But if you only watched your dollar or whatever travel and what it actually could do, I know for a fact it makes a difference. And then if it's only $10, I tell people in the United States, if it's only $10 and you think, well, $10 is going to make a difference. It certainly is. And if everyone said that, oh, my $10 is going to make a difference, then no one would donate $10. But if 10,000 people donated $10 or 100,000 people donated $10, it makes an insane difference, right? So I think it's important for people to just know and trust that wherever they're sending their money, that, you know, do some research on the organization. All of our finances are available to the public on our website, OURrescue.org. Go to the bottom, click on finance. You can see we're very, very committed to at least 70% or more of every dollar goes to the mission, to rescuing and rehabilitating. So we need help too. So I know that's another thing. Go to our website and donate money. Even if it's $10 a month, it's very easy to donate.
Yeah. I think people should do that. But also, as you say, I mean, stand up and use your voice as well. I mean, every voice, every person's voice counts. Mm-hmm. And even the $10.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, thank you, Nate, for this. I just feel really touched by this conversation. So, and I hope it's not the last, because, I mean, this fight isn't over.
No.
So,
if you want to hear more good news and cool rescue stories, follow us on our social media channels and sign up for our email. You can check out our blogs as well. And, you know, it is a dark subject, but our teams do a great job sharing amazing stories of success, and hope, and healing. It's a very uplifting. You know, we don't hang out in the darkness. We do enough of that. We don't want everybody else feeling the darkness. So we try to provide people with the light, make them see like the amazing true stories that have a great ending.
Yeah, because it's like you say. I mean, if we avoid this, you can't help these children, and they need to be rescued.
That's right. Mm.
So.
And healing. They need healing.
Yeah.
A large amount of our money goes to healing.
Thank you, Nate.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
And thank you for watching. Oh, so, bye.